On the show today, Americans prepare for a government shutdown.
Government activities that are seeking to protect life or property are very much protected and will continue, continue to operate.
Plus, the latest from Azerbaijan.
Just hours ago, the United States activated a disaster assistance response team to respond to the humanitarian needs in the South Caucasus.
And later, the U.S. House of Representatives begins an impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden, and South Sudan strengthens its relationship with Moscow. Today is Friday, September 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. President Biden has some strong words on what's at stake for the future of democracy in the United States. We'll hear about that in a moment. First, though, in the nearer term future of the United States, we're facing a government shutdown if Congress can't agree on a budget by October 1st. But what does that really mean? Does the army get to go home and the jails open up? How do citizens of the country experience the shutdown? For answers, I'm joined by Laura Blessing. She's a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University.
There are some services that will be unaffected, but a lot of services that will be. I imagine your international audience is curious about, you know, whether or not what's happening with the military, what's been happening with courts, as well as just kind of some more general questions. And, you know, a lot of military members are going to be accepted, which is a category that means that they have to continue to go to work, but they're not going to receive paychecks. So we've seen the administration talking about the hardship that that will impose on different military folks and their families. You have a limited amount of funding for federal courts to continue operating, but you also have the potential for some types of immigration hearings, having to be rescheduled. We had a huge backlog from last time for folks who are not, in custody, having to reschedule their hearings, and that's expected. And that's going to happen again with that particular type of immigration hearing. Prisons are going to continue to operate, but also more generally speaking, government activities that are seeking to protect life or property are very much protected and will continue to operate.
Having been through shutdowns in Washington, D.C. before, it seems the biggest impact really is on tourists coming to the city. The parks, the museums, a lot of federal properties are closed.
That's very true. And you know, we have so many beautiful spaces here in Washington, D.C., and, you know, those shut down during a government shutdown, which, you know, may be one of the more, visible examples of what the shutdown looks like. But certainly different Americans, whether they're looking for loans from or loan approval processes from everything from the Small Business Administration to farm farm loans processing for home mortgage loans, folks will be affected in a really significant way, even if, you know, there's not a photo of them at a national park.
How disruptive is a shutdown to the average American citizen who does not work for the government already?
Gosh, that's a great question, because it's going to vary considerably based on who that person is. And there are certain things like, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, where those benefits are outside of the yearly appropriation structure and as such are very much protected. So if, you know, folks will continue to receive their Social Security checks, of course, all these programs have to be administered by federal employees. So if they need a new card or they need to, you know, have their benefits adjusted or checked on in some way, they might have delays in that. Different folks can be pretty significantly affected. There's a variety of different programs that are going to have trouble.
Laura Blessing is a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute. That's at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Laura, thanks for your analysis today. I appreciate your time.
Great being with you.
President Biden is again warning that his predecessor, Donald Trump, whom he will likely meet again in the 2024 presidential election, represents an existential threat to democratic institutions in the United States. But do Americans really care? Patsy Wiedekuswara has the story.
It's the sharpest rebuke yet from President Joe Biden against his predecessor, Donald Trump, the man he is likely to meet again in the 2024 U.S. presidential election.
Trump says the Constitution gave him, quote, the right to do whatever he wants as president, end of quote. I've never heard a president say that in jest. Not guided by the Constitution or by common service and decency toward our fellow Americans, but by vengeance and vindictiveness.
Despite four criminal indictments, Trump remains the front runner among Republican primary voters.
In fact, I'm getting a little concerned because we had a poll this weekend that was so big, I said, here we go, more indictments. Every time we get a good poll, we get indicted.
As he gears up for his re-election campaign, Biden repeated his warning of the threat to democracy posed by Trump supporters.
There's something dangerous happening in America now. There's an extremist movement that does not share the basic beliefs in our democracy.
It's the president's fourth speech highlighting the dangers of election denialism and political violence looming over the country since thousands of Trump supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, seeking to overturn Biden's electoral victory. Chris Jackson of Ipsos Polls.
It's an issue that he's on pretty strong ground with. It's an issue that his base, Democrats, care strongly about. It's a way that it really draws a very bright line between him and his presumptive challenger, Donald Trump. And, you know, I think it will fundamentally give Biden something positive to talk about his own record, as opposed to the economy, which the record is a little bit mixed so far.
Largely due to Americans' concerns over Biden's handling of the economy, various polls show his public approval rating stagnating below 50% since August 2021. Biden is also facing an impeachment inquiry from House Republicans over allegations of corruption in relation to his son's business dealings. The White House denies any wrongdoing and dismisses the investigation as politically motivated. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
And as we've just heard, House Republicans have launched their first formal impeachment inquiry hearing against President Biden. The AP's Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani has that part of the story.
James Comer and other GOP committee chairs say there is a clear link between the president and his son Hunter's overseas businesses.
A mountain of evidence revealing how Joe Biden abused his public office for his family's financial gain.
Democrat Jamie Raskin says there is no evidence the president did anything wrong.
No gun, no smoke.
And key witnesses like George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley, who was called by the GOP, say so far,
I do not believe that the current evidence would support articles of impeachment.
The hearing unfolded with the Democrats displaying a screen counting down the hours and minutes until a government shutdown.
People are going to be hurt when this time runs out.
With Maryland's Kwasi Mfume blasting Republicans for wasting the time on a political stunt.
Why in the hell are we playing this game?
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. At least six people were killed and more than 10 injured in a car bombing Thursday in a busy meat market in the central Hirshabel state in Somalia. It's about 220 kilometers north of Mogadishu. Three people are confirmed dead on Thursday after a gunman shot into a classroom at a university hospital campus and a nearby house in the Dutch city of Rotterdam. Scientists cannot make contact with India's moon lander and rover, which made a historic landing on the south pole of the moon in August. They were put into a sleep mode earlier this month to survive the freezing lunar night temperatures of less than minus 200 degrees Celsius. And veteran actor Michael Gambon, who was known to many for his portrayal of Hogwarts headmaster Albus Dumbledore in 6 of the Harry Potter films, has died. He was 82. For the latest from the Nagorno-Karabakh region, the humanitarian situation, and the future of the Azerbaijan-Armenia-Russian relationship, I'm joined by Oskar Asgarov, managing editor of VOA's Azerbaijani service.
Well, Steve, we are seeing a large number of Armenians leaving Karabakh as hundreds of cars have been lined up to cross into Armenia. Just hours ago, the United States activated a disaster assistance response team to respond to the humanitarian needs in the South Caucasus, already having pledged $11.5 million in assistance to those in need. The head of USAID, Samantha Power, just visited Armenia and Azerbaijan to discuss the ongoing crisis with the top officials of those countries.
Now, we know that Azerbaijan has essentially taken over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, and they've said they will protect the rights and the safety of the Armenian citizens there. Has that been happening?
Well, the Azerbaijani government officials have stated that they are ready to guarantee the rights and safety of Karabakh Armenians in accordance with the constitution. One does not know how many Karabakh Armenians will be reassured of that. The images we're seeing coming from the area are that many do not. And the main questions right now are how many Armenians will remain in Karabakh and how those who do would integrate into the Azerbaijani society and continue to live under Azerbaijani governance.
Has that been a peaceful coexistence before this most recent hostility?
No, this is a continuation of a conflict that predates, goes back to late 1980s when the conflict erupted over Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia and Azerbaijan were both under the rule of Moscow at the time. But as Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 and these two countries became independent, it turned into a full-blown war in the years of 1992-94. And then there was a ceasefire in 1994, which essentially froze the conflict. And with the exception of occasional flare-ups and clashes, the status quo pretty much held until September of 2020, when what observers call the Second Karabakh War broke out. And since then, the tensions have remained high in the region. And what transpired last week was pretty much the continuation of the adversarial relations that Azerbaijan and Armenia have had over this region.
Now, we know there were Russian peacekeepers on the ground. How does this situation affect the relationship between Baku and Moscow and Armenia and Moscow? Geopolitically, what's going to happen next?
Well, I think one can observe with some degree of certainty that the Russian influence has waned in South Caucasus. It's not just that the relations between the government of Nikol Pashinyan and Vladimir Putin have been rocky for the last several years. I think it's just the observable fact that the Russian presence is not what it used to be. I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine has significantly depleted Russia's political, military, and some degree moral capital to mediate or to influence the developments in the region. But I'd say it's more than that. The Second Karabakh War took place in 2020 when Russia had not yet invaded Ukraine. And I think it was a testament to the growing Turkish influence in South Caucasus. Azerbaijan's strong political and economic military ties are not just with Turkey, but also with Israel have changed the dynamics in the region.
Oskar Asgarov is managing editor of VOA's Azerbaijani service. Oskar, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your reporting on this issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Coming up on the program, South Sudan appears to be getting closer to Russia as India and Canada are getting farther apart. We'll take a look at the possible U.S. role in mediating that relationship. The United States struck security agreements this week with Pacific Island nations, seen as a key part of U.S. plans to counter China's territorial expansion. But after 3 years of negotiations, one of those Pacific nations, the Marshall Islands, still has not reached a deal with Washington. And it's all because of how the agreement describes money for compensation for U.S. nuclear testing during the early part of the Cold War. VOA's Jessica Stone reports.
Within days of Washington providing diplomatic recognition for two additional Pacific Island nations, the U.S. has failed to extend economic assistance to three others. That assistance is part of the Compacts of Free Association, which give Washington exclusive access to large parts of the Pacific Ocean, surrounding Micronesia, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. Funds run out September 30th.
You would have to say that there was mission failure.
Howard Hills negotiated those compacts alongside Presidential Envoy Ambassador Joseph Yoon. He left his position September 7th. Deals with Micronesia and Palau have been reached while talks with the Marshall Islands have stalled. President David Kabua says the Republic still has one remaining demand.
But the United States must realize that the Marshallese people require that the nuclear issue be addressed.
In an interview with VOA, Hill says the State Department won't let Yoon officially designate the funds as compensation for the effects of American nuclear tests in the Marshalls 60 years ago.
If it were not for the State Department legal position, this could have been done in 2020. It could have been done in 2021. It could have been done in 2022.
The State Department declined to comment on that assertion, but tells VOA that without new funding, Micronesia and the Marshall Islands can use unspent funds or their compact trust funds to meet their budget needs. Palau still has another year of funding. Congresswoman Aumua Imada Radawagan says she saw firsthand the devastating impact of the nuclear testing on the Marshallese people. She spent part of her childhood in the Marshall Islands when her father was the head of government.
This boy had all kinds of cancer. He had to deliver this boy to his family. And things like that stick in my mind. I was a teenager then.
Yoon has said publicly that Washington bears a moral and political responsibility to address the impact of nuclear testing. And the MOU signed with the Marshall Islands provides $700 million for a trust fund that could be used for that purpose. But Hill says the State Department legal team has refused to officially designate any funds for nuclear compensation because of broader concerns over legal liability.
Some of the players in this would rather preside over a failure that they control than over a success that they don't control. And success was in reach, and we didn't get there.
In a letter to lawmakers last week, Congresswoman Radawagan warned that China is waiting for an opening to grow its Pacific presence.
There's another large country just sitting there, keeping their fingers crossed, hoping that this deal fails so they can step right in.
Radawagan says lawmakers are ready to fund the agreement as soon as one is finally reached. Jessica Stone, VOA News.
Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday said that relations between Russia and South Sudan were developing intensively. VOA's Kim Lewis has that story.
Speaking at a meeting with the South Sudan President Salva Kiir in Moscow, Putin noted Russia was one of the first countries to recognize the sovereignty and independence of South Sudan. Kiir said he was happy for the warm welcome and stressed that he was in Moscow as an opening to work together in the future.
I'm happy for the warm welcome that has been given to us with my delegation.
The meeting took place as the Kremlin seeks more allies amid the military campaign in Ukraine. Kim Lewis, VOA News.
Since Canada's claim that agents of the Indian government played a role in the killing of a Sikh leader on Canadian soil, the diplomatic relationship between the two countries has grown tense. VOA's Veronica Baldaras Iglesias looks at the role the United States might be playing amid this dispute between two allies.
As the world watches India's and Canada's rift over the killing of a Sikh separatist on Canadian soil continues to play out. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met Thursday with Indian Foreign Minister Subramaniam Jaishankar. So far, the U.S. has remained tight-lipped about whether it is playing a mediation role. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
I'm not going to speak to what they say in private diplomatic conversations. I will speak to what I say, or what we say, and that is we urge them to cooperate with the Canadian investigation.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has claimed in front of the House of Commons and on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly that agents of the Indian government played a role in the killing of Hardeep Singh Nijjar. An outspoken advocate for an independent Sikh state in India, who was gunned down in a Vancouver suburb in June. While India's government viewed Nijjar as a fugitive terrorist, it called Canada's allegation, quote, absurd. But Jaishankar said India is willing to look at the evidence. Leland Lazarus is a security researcher at Florida International University.
We still need to find out those specifics, but it does raise the question about territorial sovereignty, about whether a democracy can protect its citizens, and whether democracies can trust each other.
Without distancing itself from key ally Canada, it is in the best interest of the U.S. to grow closer to New Delhi, according to international relations expert at the University of Southern California, Patrick James.
Not to antagonize India and to befriend India in a period where there are genuine concerns about whether there are enough resources to contain the Sino-Russian coalition, which looks very aggressive right now.
As the Sikh community in different parts of the world demands answers, U.S. officials have encouraged India to cooperate with the Canadian investigation and stressed that transnational repression anywhere in the world is a concern for Washington. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a recent interview, Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, Bonnie Jenkins, shed light on the efforts undertaken by the State Department to advance global denuclearization. The denuclearization process is not solely about disarmament, said Undersecretary Jenkins.
Denuclearization really is much wider than most people think. They think it's just get rid of a nuclear weapon, which is important, but it's also making sure countries don't acquire them. Another thing is making sure that individuals don't have the material to do nuclear smuggling. So that's also activities that prevent non-state actors from getting their hands on nuclear materials. So you also have to worry about the individuals, not just states.
At the center of the denuclearization effort lies the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a landmark agreement involving over 180 countries that stands as a testament to international cooperation aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. Additionally, the State Department also engages in capacity-building measures, noted Undersecretary Jenkins.
The regime also includes other things. It includes activities that are called capacity-building measures, which are efforts where we work with countries to find ways in which they can prevent things like nuclear smuggling or prevent countries from getting their hands on nuclear weapons, or ways in which we try to interdict if a nuclear weapon is acquired.
The United States also employs sanctions and export controls on countries involved with the development of nuclear weapons. International partnerships such as the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and the UN Committee on Disarmament are fundamental in denuclearization efforts, stated Undersecretary Jenkins.
We also work with the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, which does a lot of work on nuclear safety, security, and safeguards, which is making sure that countries don't use nuclear material to develop nuclear weapons. We work here at the UN, for example, the First Committee on Disarmament, which meets every year in October. And that's where countries get together to talk about and deal with issues of disarmament of nuclear weapons. We have people who are constantly having bilateral meetings with other governments on issues of denuclearization.
Collaboration, diplomacy, and international agreements remain paramount in the pursuit of peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.